time for You Oughta Know, a weekly conversation about all things automotive with your host, Toby Edmonds.
Well, welcome, Toby. How you doing?
Good morning, Mike. You know, it is constant. It never ceases to amaze me. You leave and up someplace just like by a couple minutes late, and it just throws the whole traffic pattern off.
You know, I've noticed that even in a place like the Palmer area where we look out and say, oh, there's not much in the way of traffic, except that things happen. I know in particular now that school has started.
School zones are a big one, yep.
We have both getting out of the door school situations, but we also have, obviously, school buses everywhere.
Yes.
As to that. But I was thinking, have been focused, as I think many people have, looking at what's happening in Houston, Texas. I'm struck by, I'm reminded more, I think, of how we live our lives going along and occasionally have some little thing happen. Oh, there might be a little thing with a car that happens, and oh, I got a flat tire, fix that, okay. But this is like everybody having a flat tire at the same time. And I think the term that's often used is overwhelmed. There were images, and I'm sure many people have seen, of vehicles submerged in water.
Yep.
And I'm thinking, okay, there's 6 million people in the Houston area. And you've been to Houston, I'm guessing?
I've been to Austin several times. Austin.
Okay. And Austin's getting wet, but not quite right. Like Houston. I happen to have been at a conference in downtown Houston. I've watched some of those pictures. I was there walking along that street, which is now 20 feet underwater, and saying, this is a downtown area. You have the oil complex. You have millions of people living their lives one way or another with their vehicles. As we're focused on vehicles, I'm thinking about that, saying, this is enormous. How many, anyone even have an idea at this point of how many vehicles are going to be underwater for a period of time, or maybe partially submerged, et cetera. And when the waters finally recede, we have a number of people. I think there was one report I just saw where someone was saying they had bought a brand new Acura, had made the first payment, and it was underwater. You know, and that brings up all those kinds of things about insurance. What kind of insurance do you have? Does insurance cover this or that loss and so on? But I think it's the widespread, the size of this, a Katrina-like event, billions and billions of dollars of one sense, but the personal tragedy or reflection about, even if you thought you've prepared and you have this vehicle, which you're taking care of, over and over again, many people are going to have that story of what happened.
You know, you're right. And whenever we see natural disasters like this, it's horrible in itself, especially for those people who are going through it, experiencing it. I mean, as you noted, the personal tragedy and the personal loss is something that I don't think that unless you've lived through something of that caliber, you could possibly even start to fathom. But, you know, since we're discussing all things automotive, obviously when you have that type of an event, which your car is buried underneath 20 feet of water, as you even partially submerged, you're dealing with a level of damage which can be both devastating to the current owner or any owners in the future. Because a lot of those cars will unfortunately see their way back into the market. Even after the insurance companies total them, because that's what's going to happen. I mean, you can't take a car and put it in 20 feet of water and pull it out and expect everything to be fine. Mm-hmm. Not unless everything is mechanical on it and you go through it and get rid of the water. I mean, then you might be able to salvage it. But for the most part, if your car has any form of a control module in it, it's going to be a total loss. Just because electronics and water, I'm sure everybody knows, does not mix. Mm-hmm. But like I said, you know, it's those cars that people in the automotive industry, especially if they involve themselves in any sort of resale. So like used car lots, even dealerships, really, they have to be extra careful when purchasing vehicles, especially from insurance auto auctions in the future, because flood cars can be very dangerous because there's no appearance of any damage. You can look at it, the car is nice and straight, and especially if somebody went through and cleaned it out properly, got all the water out of there, dried it out, it will appear to be a very nice car until you go to drive it. And even then, the damage might not even appear for another 6, 7, 8 months down the road, because water damage does, it creeps. And just because the car is running and driving doesn't mean that it won't suffer some sort of massive failure in the future because of that water damage that occurred to the car. So it can be very dangerous for all parties involved for buying used cars after major events like this. And it is something that we did see after Katrina as well.
Uh-huh. Well, we have had that example of Katrina and even locally, since we've had some flooding and occasionally vehicles are involved in being submerged partially or completely. I guess my sense would be it's the partial submerging that is the interesting one, because you say partially submerged, of course, that could mean anything from 6 inches above the floorboards to higher, et cetera, so that you're not quite sure, okay, what has been damaged, et cetera.
The majority of modules you are going to find, especially on like higher end vehicles, ones that have like electronic everything, you'd be surprised how many modules are just underneath the carpeting. Oh. So it does not take a lot of water to get in there and do some pretty extensive damage.
So if someone has a vehicle, let's switch to a situation where there's someone who has a vehicle here, and when we have our occasional flooding, they drive through, you get that situation where you see the puddle and you think it's a puddle, but it's actually a little deeper, and you drive through and maybe get a little bit of water that comes into the vehicle, doesn't submerge. In fact, it might drive right on through. So there you are. What should a person do having done that?
Dry it out, get it home, get it into a garage if you have one. It really kind of depends. I mean, if you have standing water in the footwells, at that point in time, unless you want to live with a nasty mildew smell, maybe take it to a professional detailing shop. And they can, where push comes to shove, they could even remove the carpeting. At that point in time, you're definitely going to want to call your insurance company, right, and try to do a claim, because that's going to be very expensive, very involved.
Okay. Are there any vehicles that you know of that are more protected from water damage of that sort than others? I think my image is of vehicles that have electrical systems and these modules and so on that are scattered a variety of places, and vehicle is not intended to be submerged into water, dipped and said, okay, we can dip this into water like my watch to 10 feet, but it'll be okay. Are there any vehicles that are?
No. Most manufacturers design their vehicles under the assumption that the car will never see the underside of a massive body of water. Okay. So really, unless you have like a Jeep or a Land Cruiser, something that's kind of built to be high and above and is very mechanical oriented, for the most part, anytime a vehicle comes into contact with, a massive amounts of water, and it does happen at least once every spring, in which we do get a car up here who goes through what seems to be a puddle, but is not, small pond. Sure. In the middle of the road, and they drive through. And at that point in time, actually, your biggest danger is not getting water inside of the vehicle, because, door seals, unless the vehicle is actually submerged in water, just driving through it, you're more than likely not going to get water inside of the vehicle. Because, like I said, the door seals and everything really help prevent that. Your biggest worry at that point in time is driving through the water and sucking up some water into your intake, and it gets inside of the engine, and then you have an even bigger problem, because I'm sure most people out there know that water doesn't compress.
Right.
Things that don't compress are an engine's biggest enemy.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's actually more of a fear rather than getting water inside of the vehicle. In Alaska, that's our biggest concern is sucking water inside the engine.
So are there some vehicles that have better undersides than others? I'm thinking I've been under a few cars and I've looked and I said some seem to have protection and some seem to be very complicated. Everything is visible and so on. Have modern vehicles provided a, even just on a basic level, a splash protection so that knowing that you're going to be driving through rain, at least in some puddles, that water doesn't get splashed up into places where it shouldn't be?
Most vehicles will actually come equipped with, especially if they're kind of a little bit lower to the road, they'll come with equipped with a, a lot of people call them skid plates. They're not really skid plates because they're just made kind of from a heavy duty plastic. So it's not meant to take the vehicle off-roading by any means. It's just there to kind of help protect it from excessive water. Like we were just talking about, sticks, rocks, everything kind of flying up there into the engine compartment and generally being where it's not supposed to be. As you can probably imagine, a stick inside the serpentine belt area is never a good thing. So, you know, and we do live up here in Alaska. I mean, a lot of our roads are dirt. So you are going to be going into areas, even though your vehicle is not, you know, you're not technically off-roading. It's still areas in which, you know, you might find yourself in a situation in which stuff is kind of flying around. And so those sound dampening pans is really what they're called, because that's, you know, they do help absorb the sound, the road noise coming up from the road. But, you know, dual purpose, it does provide the underside of the engine a little bit of protection.
Okay. Well, I've been spending, switching a little bit here, I've been spending a lot of time at the Alaska State Fair. In fact, this is day five. And I have to say that it's a busy place, a lot of people there. I know in the past there have been some events involving vehicles, monster truck mashes or one thing or another. Is that, are you noticing that this year, or anyone involved that you know?
No one that I know of is involved this year. In the past, we've, as a shop, have put demolition cars in. We don't have the time this year. We're putting an addition back onto the back of the shop, and that between that plus just regular life in general, we just didn't have enough time. But it should still be. I mean, they always put on a really good event. It should be. It's so much fun to watch.
Right.
So, you know, even if you're not really into that type of scene, you really should give it a chance and go out there and at least watch one time.
I just realized I'm thinking about this. Okay, there you are. You repair these vehicles. So you create this and you send it into danger. You say, go and break another vehicle.
You know, it's kind of actually, yes. I mean, you're right. And when you're in a demolition derby, obviously stuff is going to get wrecked. But when you have the consideration that the idea is make the vehicle, whoever has the vehicle running at the very end, you know, it is kind of in a way a test to your repair skills, your modification skills, your fabrication skills, because the idea is to build a car that's so tough that, you know, getting hit multiple times by people inside of an arena is not enough to kill it. So, you know, you're right. But I mean, once again, we're also considering that we're using cars that, you know, we wouldn't normally put on the road either. So
okay. So I've asked a couple of questions. Did you have something in particular in mind that you wanted to talk about?
You know, as we come up into the time of year in which it gets darker.
Yes.
I refuse to use the W word or the S word right now. You know, the nights are starting to get a little bit darker. It's time to start paying attention to your headlights. And being able to be seen and see at night. Make sure if you don't have a car that's equipped with the bulb indicator, letting you know if you have a burnt out bulb, you know, do a walk around with your vehicle, make sure all of your lights are working, make sure everything is taken care of. Replace the bulbs as needed if you need help. Most shops will install the bulbs for free if you're a recurring customer. I know my shop does.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a simple bulb to get to, we just, you know, we'll just generally pop it in for you in the parking lot. You know, some of them do take a little bit of extra time, but at that point in time, you can, you know, we'd notify you.
Sure.
which is another crazy thing. You'd be surprised how many cars. it's an adventure trying to replace a headlight bulb. But
I have been there, and that's the craziness. Some, I mean, are literally pop the bulb in. Others are remove the bumper and or whatever, and go on down and doing it. And this morning, as turns out, I noticed even with there were only two vehicles. 50% of them had a headlight out.
Absolutely.
You know? I mean, it was very interesting.
Because, you know, it's summertime, nobody really notices or, you know, whatever. And then it starts getting darker and suddenly you realize you've been running around with a headlight bulb that's been out for, you know, 3 months.
Okay. So recently we talked about oil. We talked about expensive oil. We talked about less expensive oil. So now we're talking about bulbs. Are there better bulbs? I know there are different kinds of bulbs, but in terms of quality of price, what's the bulb story?
Really, as far as giving a recommendation on a brand, you know, I can't really say that. One thing I can say is those bright lights, the Sylvania bright lights or whatever they are, be very careful with those. First of all, the quality of light that you're actually going to get out of them is, I mean, you do get a better quality of light than if you were to just put in, the bulb that's, you know, right next to it hanging on the shelf. But what we see more often than not is damage to bulb connectors and wiring harnesses from the amount of power that they have to draw in order to illuminate.
Okay, so you're doing an aftermarket insertion of a bulb into the standard socket wiring.
Yeah, so you're taking a headlamp bulb that uses power to an excessive amount of power in order to illuminate. And if we've seen multiple times in which it has melted wiring harnesses and connectors in headlights. Is that the norm? No. Is that supposed to happen? No. But, you know, it is something to consider if you feel like upgrading to a better quality of light. That being said, I mean, really, once again, with bulbs, what you're going to necessarily see is not so much a difference in lighting. That's pretty much going to be standard across the board. Really, what you're going to see as far as major difference in bulbs and price is how long they last. And the other thing is that if you have one headlight go out, it's just a good idea just to replace the other one while you're at it too. Especially if the car is newer, so the bulbs were put in at the exact same time.
Right.
They both have the same amount of miles, same amount of illumination period. I mean, it's just good practice just to replace them in a pair. If you have xenon headlights or HIDs, same thing. If you do decide to replace that bulb yourself, which they can be kind of difficult. Replace that bulb yourself, you are going to see two different types of lighting. A brand new xenon bulb looks a lot different than another different HID or xenon bulb that's been installed and been in use for quite a while. So don't panic if you see one that looks kind of pink and the other one is just the normal standard bright white.
So from the standpoint of two people, one driving the vehicle with these two different shades of light, and also from the standpoint of someone who's coming towards you, is any comments about that?
It'd be a bit odd just to see, you know, two different shades of bulbs coming at you. There are a lot of people that really hate cars that come equipped with HIDs or xenons because the light can be very bright. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of people associate the most obnoxious bright white ones with lights that have maybe been installed aftermarket.
Right.
And somebody did not aim them correctly or perhaps used a higher powered ballast. And in that particular case, obviously it's a system that's not being used correctly.
So in the old days, aiming headlights seemed to be pretty easy. I mean, I could pull up to my garage door and I could say, oh, I can see this one light's going over here and the other one's going off in that direction. I have a kind of a check on that. How do you find lights? Is you can check lights to say they're on, but how often are lights checked to see if they're really pointed properly?
most newer cars don't require the headlights to be aimed as often as older ones.
Okay.
There's not a lot of adjustments you can make.
Good.
You can aim them to a certain extent, but really it's very limited because these, you know, newer cars are designed that once the headlight is in there, barring any damage or, you know, impact, it's going to stay true.
Okay.
The other thing that you kind of brought up that is actually a really good point. You know, if you do decide to check your headlights and see how well they're aimed, don't panic if the passenger one is pointed down and slightly off to the right.
Oh.
A lot of cars are designed that way, so that way it illuminates the side of the road as you're driving.
Got it.
So don't panic if you see that one slightly askew.
Okay. So that leads me to my favorite, what I've seen now more and more, is light bars, what look like LED light mm-hmm. bars. I've never driven a vehicle with one. I'm just wondering whether they are effective or not.
Oh, they can be very effective and also very dangerous for oncoming traffic if used improperly. Light bars can be very, very, I mean, they can be lifesavers. If you're going down some of these, you know, dark Alaskan roads and maybe there's no oncoming traffic, so you switch that on, then all of a sudden, I mean, you see everything, including moose. And that's what most people use them for, is making sure that they don't run into one of those cute little moose alongside of the road.
Okay. Okay. What I do also, since we're talking about lights, notice fewer and fewer vehicles having spotlights on the side that you aim and do something with. In fact, I haven't seen a vehicle, a more modern vehicle, with the exception perhaps of even police or troopers that have a spotlight. Have they gone away?
I think that the big ones that we associate with, especially cop cars, those really have been replaced by smaller units, smaller handheld units.
Okay.
LED lights have become incredibly powerful. Mm-hmm. And incredibly reliable. So I think most cars have opted for, instead of having something hanging off the side that's in danger of, you know, hitting something or being hit, it's more handheld, smaller, more compact units that can be stored inside the car and used as needed.
Okay. And lastly, I notice more and more vehicles have automatic lights stay on, both headlights and interior lights, and then you get out, you lock the car, and then sometime later, everything goes off. Mm-hmm. That seems to be pretty much the common occurrence.
Oh, yeah, and it is very nice to have that because, you know, gives you time after you get out of your vehicle to make sure you got everything, make sure everything is taken care of, plus it gives you a little bit of light when you're walking up to the front of your house. That is a setting in most cars that you can manipulate. You can either turn it on, turn it off, let it stay on for 30 seconds, let it stay on for 15 seconds. If you don't see the setting in your instrument cluster to where you can set it yourself, sometimes an automotive repair shop can use a scan tool to change the settings in the instrument cluster.
Okay, it's good to know. Well, I think we've come pretty close to the end of another edition of You Ought to Know. Toby, do you have any last comments before we finish?
If you ever have anything automotive related, questions, suggestions, even if you just want to talk cars, we at Edmunds Import Auto are always more than happy to help. You can find us across from the Alaska State Fairgrounds. The fair time scare you about getting it out of the shop. We have our methods of getting you in and out in a way where you don't have to deal with traffic.
Okay. Thank you again, Toby Edmunds.
Thank you.
We'll be talking again next week.
You've been listening to You Ought to Know with Toby Edmunds. This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions, please email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.